Hello there. We're Vince and Elliot McNally.
Yes, the great-great-grandsons of map-making mogul Rand McNally.
And we'll be your hosts and tour guides on a trip across America, one small town at a time.
In the spirit of our great-great-grandfather, we're traveling the country writing the family's first almanac in over 50 years, Towns and Country, the McNally Brothers' comprehensive guide to small-town America.
Each week we'll be in a new town, and after getting to know the place and the people, we'll tell you, the listener, all there is to know.
In a show we call These Parts, a podcast putting towns on the map. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of These Parts. I'm one of your hosts, Elliot McNally, and with me, as always, is my brother, friend, and traveling companion, Vince McNally. How's it going, Vince?
It's going great, Elliot, and this week we're also explorers together. I feel like our great-great-grandfather must have, as he traipsed across the unmapped landscape of the American West, discovering a new wonder at every turn.
Vince, I know exactly what you mean. This week, we're really getting back to our roots, really getting back to Rand McNally's roots. When he wasn't exploring towns, he was exploring the country and getting in touch with a little thing he liked to call nature.
I like to call it that too, Elliot.
A lot of critics disprove him actually coining the term nature. A lot of people attribute it to his longstanding feud with John Muir.
That said, I like to stand behind our great-great-grandfather in times like this. I trust him implicitly, and I trust that when people were seeking, much like those sought out in nature, a word to describe the wilderness, he was ready with a coined phrase.
And I think I'm as ready as I'll ever be to put this town on the map.
Couldn't agree more, Elliot. Let's do it. But let's not do it alone.
So listeners at home, take out your comprehensive U.S. wall map, your commemorative push pins. Maybe your map's already on your wall, displayed proudly like ours is. Maybe you have to unsheath or unfold or unfetter it. Whatever it is, take out this amazing map and look to a more serene and natural part of the country up in Wyoming.
That's right. The Union's least populous state. But it makes up for the shortage of people with a treasure trove of natural spoils.
And although it has the least amount of people, we snagged one of them today to help us put this town on the map. Listeners, this week we are in Mauvstone, Wyoming. It is a sister town and park to the National Park Yellowstone. It is home to some of nature's
Less impressive.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Geological wonders. Would you introduce yourself?
Hey, boys. This is Rod Jad, head of Parks and General Tourist Appreciation Department for the park.
Rod, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, of course. I mean, honestly, we don't get too many people in any given 2 to 3 month period, so any human interaction is just a real treat.
I have noticed that there, as we've been walking around this week, there haven't been too many other people.
Yeah, you know, it's, I like to think of it as, you know, kind of a blessing in disguise, because then, you know, the more foot traffic you have, the less pristine the landscape can really remain. It's becoming a problem with some of the more popular parks in the nation, but we just don't even have to think about it.
That's a good point.
Well, Mr. Jod, would you do the honors and stick a pin in your beautiful town of Mauvstone for us?
All right, I look for it here. It's not generally printed very prominently on most maps, so I kind of have to do sort of a relative positioning triangulation type thing with surrounding towns and this should be about right.
Great.
Thanks. Well done. A more mathematical approach to the pin sticking than we've had before.
Well, you know, it's sometimes you spend a lot of time sitting in your little station looking at the map, and you know, sometimes you realize not really much going on there in regards to our own park. It's mostly a lot of information of surrounding areas and restaurants that might be popular.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. How did you get to Mauvstone? It's a hidden gem, if there ever was one here in the American West. How does a person like yourself, a proud ranger, land himself in such a remote area?
Well, I had what you might call a bit of a falling out with the Park Service a few years ago. I saw a young bear wandering through the wilderness, and it looked a bit parched from what I could tell. It was panting heavily, so I threw it back into my Range Rover, and brought it back to my my residence, and you know, just kind of drew a bath for it and locked it in the bathroom, and just figured once it calmed down, it would get hydrated, you know, and drink through that bathtub water and get hydrated. Turns out that is a federal crime to take an animal off of a preserve, off a national park.
That's a bear napping, I think, is the actual legal term. Unlucky, especially because you were just trying to do right by your conscience. So instead of jail time, they stationed you out here in Mauvstone?
It was kind of a choice given to me by the judge, you know, and I find that, you know, if I'm going to be isolated from most human contact, I'd rather do it in the beautiful great outdoors rather than a, you know, private institution.
Well, that makes all the sense in the world to me. Elliot, I'm just chomping at the bit, much like that bear must have been chomping at the door handle of the bathroom.
Oh, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, that it just you know, went through that brass knob like a gobstopper.
Well, I can hardly wait to talk about all the natural beauty that does lay bare here in Mauvstone. I think we should go ahead and just jump right into our first segment.
Let's talk about all the bare necessities of Mauvstone in At Long Last.
So, listeners, you'll know if you're a longtime fan of the show that Elliot and I are a bit of geography buffs. That's why we're undertaking this great journey across the United States. And we have a full segment dedicated just to the type of landmarks and geographical and geological wonders that might lie in the towns that we visit. What a place to showcase this segment, because Mauvstone is famous for just that.
Even though it's famous for some of the less impressive geological wonders, they are geological wonders nonetheless. And walking around the park, you know, it's still a national park. You're still going to have tourist attractions that everyone's going to want to see. So, Rod, what is, in your opinion, the main thing to see when in Mauvstone?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, it's so hard to choose. We've got such a menagerie of, you know, just formations and striations and just general rock-related fun. But I guess I would say, I mean, the crown jewel, in my opinion, would probably be what we call God's Toenail.
And so what is God's Toenail, for those of us who don't know?
You know, a big portion of the park is just sort of what I believe are known as salt flats, which you can probably guess by the name what that kind of entails. Just sort of a flat, lifeless plane of, you know, sodium elements. But there's this very beautiful space about a half-mile walk from the entryway to the park where the ground kind of just rises up in this ever-so-slight ridge that if you squint, you kind of think to yourself, geez, it's almost like if our great Lord above were clipping his toenails. And probably the third toe in, I don't know if there's a name for that, whichever pig that might be, just sort of fell down to the earth and landed and embedded itself in the salt flats, probably from the velocity, I imagine. I've read up a little bit about asteroid impacts, and it sounds like it's pretty intense if anything comes down from that high.
I think it was probably walking around the park one of the most attractive features, because it is sort of desolate around here. But if you squint a little bit, I definitely see the resemblance to God's Toenail.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of our attractions, part of their beauty comes from the fact that they're not much else going on visually. So, you know, any kind of sudden change in the landscape is sort of an exciting surprise.
Well, in my opinion, and I'm sure yours too, when you go to these national parks, there's almost a sensory overload of the amount of stuff you can see.
Oh,
so when you take that away and give the viewer just a little bit, it pays off in the end.
Right. It's like a minimalist painting, except it's just, you know, it's just our great country itself is the canvas.
Very well said.
Eloquently put.
Can we talk about some of the maybe less strictly geological features? Talk about some of the water features here at Mauvstone. That's something I think that the park really doesn't get enough credit for. There are many to choose from, but I, of course, am thinking of Old Philanderer, your most famous geyser.
Oh, sure, yeah. The OP, as we like to call it, internally within the Park Service. It has what we like to call a extremely irregular eruption schedule, which is to say it has not actually erupted for, 72 years. But we're pretty confident that it hasn't completely died and it will erupt again. So part of the fun for our park goers in any given day is that, you know, this could be it. You know, they could be there to witness history.
So it's sort of like just an unpredictable phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, if you go to our gift shop, you'll notice one of our best-selling T-shirts, it just says, cross your fingers. That's kind of the unofficial slogan of the park.
That something of value might happen.
Right, like that this could be the time when the park finally, offers its few gifts, admittedly, to whoever happens to be in the park that day.
You know, I've noticed that a lot of features in the park have OL in front of them, OL apostrophe. Mm-hmm. So there's Old Philanderer, there's Old Tree, there's Old Ranger Station. I know the park itself isn't actually that old. Is this an attempt to make it seem more established?
I mean, it's not so much an attempt as just an assumption. You know, I mean, like I say, there's not too much going on here. So we just figure, like, this has probably been around for a while, or we probably would have, there'd be a little more documentation about most of these phenomena in the record. So we just sort of assume things have been sitting quiet for a good long while. And only recently have people taken enough notice to turn it into a park, a national park, with those the protections and restrictions that come with it.
Well, and it was turned into it. The newest segment of the park was actually built on what was an old mini mall.
Yes, that is correct. Went out of business back in, I believe, 82. And then sat vacant for, I believe, 6 to 7 years. And, you know, part of that reason, again, is the just general surrounding landscape. People aren't really looking for discount Land's End in the middle of the salt flats, if you know what I mean.
That's a great point. It reminds me of one of my favorite features, the old Orange Julius, which the growth that has resulted as of a fact of the smoothie flavoring leaking into the earth has really produced some beautiful vegetation.
Yeah, you know, it's there's some pretty unique varieties of plants growing. You know, there's the sickly cactus, there's the withered shrub, there's the sagging pine. I mean, it's really, we've had a lot of researchers coming out here in the last couple of years, just kind of to see what sort of, you know, if these plants have developed a certain resistance that maybe could be used for, you know, our more staple crops in the coming climate change cataclysm that we all assume is coming.
Well, Orange Julius and the government have been working tirelessly to establish some sort of military weapons contract, I know.
I can't speak to that officially. You know, there are certain gears turning, I will say that. I'm not really privy to most of that information other than, you know, get out of the way, Rod. But I, you know, there have definitely been some high-level government officials examining the plants, presenting the plants with certain foreign chemicals and seeing how they respond to them. I'm not going to call it chemical weapons. I've been told not to.
It's more smoothie flavoring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the base chemical, you know, that's like the foundation of it. And then, you know, they throw them in those, whatever they call them, those central spinning things.
Of course. Yes, right, right.
Well, but that's where it was a blessing in disguise, because that's where you get the mauve stones because of the berry razzmatazz smoothie machine leaking all over the stones around that area.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, when the sun is coming down around the fall equinox, it's just, I mean, it's a sight to see. It's a shame that we don't really have much of a cellular network out here, because I mean, I'm sure I could have one of those Instagrams that would just be blowing up all over the place if I could get any decent shots of that.
Speaking of Instagram and sites to see, Vince, I see a bunch of letters right in front of us from eager listeners.
And I'm just as eager as they were when they wrote them to read them.
And let's do that in a segment called Wouldn't You Like to Know?
So listeners, each and every week, we like to give you an opportunity to write in with your specific questions, queries, concerns to ourselves and our guests. This week, the indomitable Rod Jod about the specific town that we're staying in. We have time for three each and every week, and I've got the very first one.
Read it, Vince.
This one comes from Corey in North Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Great. So what has Corey written us?
Corey writes, "Hey guys, longtime listener, big fan of the show, and multi-time visitor to Milestone National Park."
Oh, look at that, Rod.
Yeah, that's the first time for everything, I guess.
Well, Corey goes on to write, "I'd love for you guys to talk about maybe the most exciting geological feature that the park has to offer, the runaway tumbleweed."
That is quite a phenomenon. I'm trying to keep that thing under control for quite a while. It's been causing, it's fun for people in principle, but honestly, like, it just causes so much potential legal problems that it really would be nice if we could finally catch that darn thing.
I cheated this week and I kind of read this letter ahead of time, which I know we're not supposed to do, Elliot.
Vince, I've talked to you about this.
It intrigued me so much that I looked into Milestone's city documents and found the case file on the tumbleweed. Jod, could you maybe explain to me some of these inclusions in the record? I'll go through a couple of them.
All right.
Here in 1991, it said tumbleweed somehow escapes from glass enclosure.
That was unexpected, I will say that. You know, there's theories that the tumbleweed is not so much just a winding collection of dried plant matter, but is in fact a, you know, several organisms sort of cohabitating into one structure. So, you know, at first we thought, well, this will be great for display. People can just sort of come read the placard about the history of the tumbleweed. But boy, did that thing get real teed off once we got it in that glass enclosure. It seemed fine for about 2 hours, but then I think it got real hot in there, and it just started shaking, just smashing itself against the glass, and making a surprising amount of noise from something that doesn't appear to have vocal cords. And then, oh man, there was a lot of small cuts that day when the glass just sort of exploded outward in the visitor center.
Well, that, I would assume, is a detriment to everything that Milestone stands on. You don't want things to be too interesting or exciting around here.
Right. I mean, you know, we like to keep a low profile. You know, it's more for, you know, maybe the family taking a round country road trip and maybe things are getting a little heated or no one can decide where they want to go or the theme parks are closed or who knows what. And maybe it's time to just go out into nature in its barest sense of the word and just sort of reset yourselves.
I do, before we move on, want to talk about this entry from 2001. It said, "Tumbleweed pulled over in Fort Laramie, Wyoming for speeding, found in a stolen Ford Pinto."
Yeah, that was, that was quite the surprise. We honestly thought we had just sort of lost the thing and maybe it had just fallen into a pit somewhere or gotten caught, you know, in a chain link fence of some variety. And then, lo and behold, I get a call from that local precinct and saying, "Rod, I hope you're sitting down for this. Caught the tumbleweed. I'm not going to describe the contents of the trunk of the car, but do know that the tumbleweed has broken several federal laws and would like to just kind of throw it back into your custody rather than, you know, the press is going to have a field day if we put this you know, ball of organic material on trial. So they figured they'd just kind of stick it back where it started, and maybe the rumors would die down after a while.
So that tumbleweed now has risen the ranks to become the head groundskeeper of Mauvstone Park.
That is correct. We found that maybe there was a theory that maybe it was just bored. It maybe just needed a little more structure in its day-to-day. So we kind of crammed a couple of garden implements into it, and just kind of let it roam around and sort of train itself. And now there's, it's on its way to getting at least, something resembling a topiary garden. I think we're going to have something real, real neat in 10 or 20 years.
Well, it is getting so big from collecting all this detritus and material that it almost threatens to consume the entire park. So maybe you're right. It may turn into its own geological feature. Fingers crossed.
It's right on the t-shirt, you know?
That's interesting, Vince. What a great letter to pick from, even though you read it ahead. This one, I guarantee I have not read ahead, so I hope it's as interesting as this first one.
It's sure to be something new that we've never heard before, Elliot.
This one comes from Victor in Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow, thanks for writing, Victor. What's he want to know?
Victor says, I used to go on so many trips with my family around the country to national parks. One of my favorite places, believe it or not, was Mauvstone.
Or not.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he does have or not written in red pen as opposed to the black pen he used for the rest of the letter. He says that he and his brother and sister would watch movies in the back seat while his parents drove, and he remembers one of his particularly favorite movies, Deliverance, that was shot and set in Mauvstone, Wyoming. And if we could talk about it.
He watched that film as a child? Is it?
Apparently. He doesn't really get into who his parents were or what decisions they were making parenting, but
yeah, I mean, that whole situation seems kind of problematic depending on the age of the child.
Well, and he seems to be a little misinformed as well, because that film was neither shot nor set in Mauvstone. It actually takes place in Georgia.
Now, do you have any, thoughts as to how he might have misconstrued the fact that Deliverance did not, in fact, take place in this remote national park?
Maybe the child in question perhaps saw the movie. I don't know exactly the age of this person. I guess as far as we know, this whole thing could be an elaborate hoax with that or not there at the beginning.
You would be surprised by how many elaborate hoax letters Vince and I get.
Oh, I can believe it. I mean, the letters I get sometimes are just, they're like practically novellas. But I guess in regards to the question of the film, there's certainly a possibility that this child was watching the film around the time that a local, I don't want to say serial killer, but perhaps a murder enthusiast seemed to be attempting to use the relative lack of human presence in the park to kind of use the grounds as, I guess, his corpse dumpster, I believe the press called it. So it's possible that the child simply associated those unrelated horrors with the film.
That's a theory that I think holds a lot of water.
Well, and Rod, now that we've cleared that up, do you have our final letter of the segment for us?
I do. I have it sitting here. It's from Marion from Roanoke, Virginia.
Great. So what has Marion written us today?
Marion, it seems, would like to know what sort of wildlife is native to the park rather than, sort of imprisoned here in a punitive nature, which has, as we mentioned with the tumbleweed, sort of become common practice for our regional and federal governments.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we've talked about kind of the desolation of the park. What wildlife do you run into on a day-to-day basis, Rod?
There's what we call the bipolar finch, and that is a beautiful bird that, on many days will simply sit in silence in the branches of a tree. It will not eat, will not drink, it will not socialize with its fellow birds. And honestly, you don't really know if they're there unless you know where to look. They tend to stay in shadier areas, or if there are some weather events occurring, birds will generally try to stay within the threatening storms. And then occasionally after, you know, between 1 and 3 weeks, the bird will unfurl itself and sing for 36 hours straight. It will then collect far more food than it would ever need to consume in a given year. And it will generally just sort of be an irritant, honestly, to any other living creature in the park. Not necessarily in a threatening manner, but just sort of as a, you know, just general overstimulated organism constantly flitting about and making very loud screeching noises in one's face.
It's unfortunate that this bird is one of the few that has no migratory pattern, and so you cannot get rid of it.
It is true. The bird, I believe, tends to stay within the grounds of the park. Every once in a while, we'll hear about one that maybe, you know, in one of its more manic phases, flew several miles outside of its general habitat, but they are very quickly either destroyed by an irritated organism or human, or they simply, you know, just sort of stop flying and descend to the earth.
Well, what a fascinating critter. Maybe you could briefly touch on an animal that I was really excited to see. Haven't seen one yet this week, but the North American trison with an extra tiny horn growing out of the side of its head.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, the trison, we haven't quite gotten too much data on it as of yet. There are some theories that suggest that it is just a regular bison that was, you know, rummaging through a pile of garbage and had some kind of container, perhaps.
One of those triangular water cooler Dixie cups, I think.
Certainly. And you know, with the level of filth inherent in a pile of garbage, it's possible that the paper Dixie cup simply collected the right combination of pigments to seemingly match the natural colors. But others theorize that the trison is, you know, the result of sort of a Galapagos Island-style, you know, isolated evolutionary track. So, you know, given a few more million years, they might find that there's a great use for that third horn here in the park.
Well, fingers crossed we find out.
Fingers crossed, there you go.
And Vince, I think that's a great segue into our next segment.
I couldn't agree more. It's a segment for those who want their tails just a little bit taller.
Unlike the North American trison, which has a very small tail.
It is either the result of a serious injury, or perhaps, given that there is so much open space, there's no need for the bison to really have any organism on the back to understand, you know, if there's anything in its surrounding area that would be a threat or an obstacle.
Well, even if that may be the case, I think we're ready for a segment we call Friend or Folk.
Now, listeners, usually we pick a character, a larger-than-life figure in our town's history to talk about, and we ask our guest to define whether it's a real person or a little bit of great old American mythology. This week, we're going to do it a little differently. Mossstone is blessed with so many folk tales and mysterious creatures that we thought we'd do a little bit of a hit list and get our guest thoughts on as many of them as we can jam into this segment.
Rod, we know that no one is the authority on Mossstone like yourself. So any myths or urban legends, you're going to be able to disprove or prove, I think.
I will certainly try.
So the first one I want to bring up, guys, is the park's almost unofficial mascot, and that's Hoagie Bear. Now, Hoagie seems, just from what I've read, to have an almost adversarial relationship with you, Rod. He goes and he steals different park goers' sandwiches for their hikes, and may or may not maul them. And I know that this sort of swirled out of your previous relationship with bears, but from what I've seen, it seems like it could be plausible.
Yes. The bear in question, again, it is, you know, it's sort of similar to the Trison, in which we are, as of now, unclear as to whether it is just a very dirty, bear-costumed human being who is simply trying to cause a little chaos within the grounds of the park. Or, you know, my current theory, personally, is that it is, in fact, the bear cub from my past come to get what I would call mild revenge.
What do you say to the allegations that he's actually wearing a tie? I mean, I've heard that this is a very sophisticated, maybe smarter than the average bear, or maybe he just dug into where the old men's warehouse was and put on a tie.
I cannot speak necessarily to the bear's intelligence in relation to other bears. My experience, bears are generally too aggressive to really gauge their intelligence, although this bear, again, spends most of its energy seemingly committing sandwich theft rather than any more traditional aggressive behavior. I have definitely seen different colored fabrics around the neck of the bear, suggesting that the bear has changed ties over time. So I would say that the tie wearing is very likely. I can't imagine that the bear would just coincidentally, you know, get a necktie just wrapped around its neck multiple times. It does suggest a deliberate costume.
Well, I call that myth confirmed, Elliot.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, let me step up to the plate next and ask about one of my favorite, not just in Mawstone, but across this entire great country, urban myths and legends. That would be Big Hands.
So, Vince, I've heard about this, but maybe you could elaborate on Big Hands.
Big Hands is some sort of creature. Some say the missing link between our ancestors of a primate nature and ourselves, who walks around dragging two big old hands behind him. He's known for doing hand-related spookiness, creating shadow puppets on canyon walls, for instance, or pickpocketing people from a great distance.
Rod, have you encountered this, or have you heard of any of the park patrons encountering Big Hands?
We have had a few possible sightings. There was, at one point, two parallel divots across the salt flats that had a knuckle-suggestive shape to them. So there is certainly a possibility that this figure has at least traversed through the park. I have not personally encountered this big-handed creature, although I have certainly heard of thefts occurring within the park. We had a young lady who was walking around with a self-picturing sticks sticking out of her back pocket. And, you know, again, she was in one of our more desolate corners of the park with maybe a few sagging pines scattered throughout. And she did say that she felt a slight rustling in the rear area of her pants. And then when she went to investigate by turning her head to the side, she found that the object for picture self-taking was gone, and she heard what she could only describe as a series of pops, suggestive of a sly young man cracking his knuckles before moving on to do more mischievous deeds.
Maybe you could clarify something for us, and maybe, Vince, you've heard other things, but I've heard that certain glove and digital experts have analyzed different markings left by Big Hands, and they say his hands are only size medium to large at most.
Well, one theory with that is that the creature, it doesn't so much drag the hands, more that simply the nature of the size of the hands when walking in a casual gait, the longest fingers perhaps drag along the ground while the rest of the hands sort of just float above. They suggest that he walks with a popped collar gait, I believe is what they're calling it, which is, sort of a, keeping the back rather straight and the chest puffed out, which by its naturally kind of brings the arms up slightly. So I would certainly personally believe that should this creature exist, that its hands are abnormally large, in fact. And I feel that statement on medium gloves may just be, certain authorities trying to keep the public from panicking.
Sure.
A creature with such large hands may be wandering the country.
If the glove does not fit, you must omit that evidence.
Exactly.
Well, Vince, I don't know if that's correct or not.
I would still call that one up in the air.
One other myth I want to bring up is the myth of a man just known as Hiram Sandberg. And he's a transplant from New York who didn't get the memo that the mall was paved over to create this park. And he apparently and allegedly still, let's say this is in quotes, walks the mall, and people hear his disgruntled rumblings and echoes throughout the evenings.
That is an ongoing tale in the park. I can't personally speak to hearing the grumblings, although I have heard park patrons say that they have, when camping in our campgrounds, sometimes while in their tents, they will hear what they have described as vintage profanity, kind of whispering along the wind. I will say I have heard, while walking the grounds at night, what sounds very much like some sort of, polyester blend, kind of rubbing against itself as if a tracksuit were very quickly and athletically walking at a reasonable pace.
Well, I know there's been definite accounts from campers saying that on cool nights you can hear some distant man saying, "Look, 5.50 for an omelet?"
I've heard that on a particularly windy evening, the canyon seemed to whistle about a man trying to return a head massager at Brookstone.
Yes, that is, I have definitely been told stories from campers that match that description. I've also been told that there has been the sound of a very old cellular phone continuing to ring with no apparent action being taken to answer said phone. And then what sounds like a phone simply being stuffed into a bag.
I know that this myth kind of got muddled when Bernie Sanders was on his campaign trail here.
We did have a few sort of PR snafus when some Hiram hunters, as they call themselves, kind of put Senator Sanders, attempted to capture him in a large net. It caused a bit of a stir. We had to have a little conversation with his campaign and with his protection.
Well, several newspapers, and I don't know why this town has so many newspapers, but several headlines read, "We got him."
Yes, it was quite a weekend when every single newspaper in the area had to print a correction, and then also apologize for not recognizing such a prominent figure in the first place, given that they are, at least say they are covering the election cycle thoroughly.
Well, little incidences and snafus like this only serve to enrich the myths that surround these great small towns, and Moffstone is no different. Elliot, we've already had such an exciting day of conversation. Let's kick this up into overdrive.
With a segment we call, Did You Know?
So Did You Know is our rapid fire trivia segment where we flip five facts back and forth about the towns that we're staying in. Listeners, we know that you don't always have time for a full show, so this is how we cater to your on-the-go needs. Elliot, do you get the first fact for us?
I do. Vincent Rod, did you know that there's a place in Moffstone National Park that humans are not allowed?
Really, Elliot? Where would that be?
It's over in the east quadrant of the park. It's protected by a roving gang of otters nicknamed the Cool Otters, and they apparently broke into one of the old Sunglass Hut back rooms and stole a bunch of sunglasses. And so if you walk over there, you're going to be met with some pretty angry rodentia wearing sunglasses, and they're not going to let you pass.
It's a terrifying sight, let me tell you.
What happens, Rod, if people do try to get over to this quadrant of the park, or what measures have you guys taken to make sure that doesn't happen?
We try to, when people first enter the park, we have a bit of an informative video. You know, it's sort of a, I guess what you'd call a smear campaign for otters. The issue is that otters are generally thought of as, you know, these very cute, playful creatures. So when parkgoers hear that there is a family of these cuddly fellas living on the park, they think, oh, that'll be great. We'll go watch the otters swim around and just generally, you know, splash around and have a good time. So we try to throw some facts out about the otters in general, and then also, you know, kind of remind them that these otters are kind of off the beaten path, shall we say, of their brethren. They have taken on some interesting qualities that, otter experts have said are completely unprecedented anywhere else. They've started wearing thin chains around their necks, made out of whatever, I guess, shiny material they can find. You know, there's not exactly... although I think there was a jewelry store here at one point, so they may have left some of the less authentic pieces around. I have definitely seen one otter with a necklace that had a rhinestone-studded centerpiece of the name Judy, which I don't know if that is the name that the otter has chosen, or if the otters even understand that that is even a word.
I think it's safe to say that that name chose the otter, and that otter is now the ringleader.
That is definitely true. I have had quite a few tense standoffs with the otter known as Judy. You know, they tend to, I don't know if you boys know this, but otters can actually snap their fingers in a very intimidating manner. And they will do that with reckless abandon if you get too close to their habitat.
They have a fervent disregard for authority.
Well, I hate to add to the mystique of the otters, but I swear to you, I spotted one wearing what seemed to be a crudely fashioned leather jacket, appearing to be made out of scraps from Joanne's Fabrics.
Yes, I can. I definitely seen an otter that seemed to have a bit more bulk than you might expect from that species. I've also seen them do what I guess I would call controlled slides across the salt flats. They don't have any motor vehicles. I think it's just sort of kind of a display of machismo.
It's their drag racing almost.
I think so. I think they just sort of run as fast as they can and then just sort of, you know, you talk about how they, you know, slide all playfully in waterfalls or what have you, but since our water features are generally dormant or long dried out, they tend to just sort of slide around in the salt.
Well, that's fascinating. I had no idea. But did you guys know that there is a specific geological feature here in Milestone that can be seen from space?
Really, Vince? What is it?
It's known as the Bland Canyon, and it is a 200-kilometer stretch of rock that goes in a very perfectly straight line.
So I'm assuming this is a very big attraction in the park, Rod.
Yes, it is. It's a big attraction in the sense that parkgoers tend to just sort of stumble upon it eventually, and then if they happen to be at one of the markers, which are only, I believe, every 10-15 kilometers, to let them know that they're at one of the park's attractions, they may take a picture and appreciate it. Although generally, if they're walking in a place without any signage, they will, just kind of step over it, or, maybe just kind of turn around thinking that it's, some kind of border, like a property line. You know, they sometimes think that on the other side is like a farm or something. and that they just are haven't finished laying the fence out.
Well, because the term canyon, Vince, is sort of loosely used.
I would say it's generously applied in this particular instance, being that the Bland Canyon is only several inches deep.
That is correct. We had a bit of an issue. It used to be about a foot and a half, but then there was a very large mudslide up in the north end of the park. And that kind of filled in the canyon to a pretty significant degree.
I still find it fascinating. Rod, do you happen to have a did you know fact for us?
Oh, certainly. Did you know? Did I say that right?
You nailed it.
Perfect.
Oh, great. Okay. Did you know that every two winters, the sagging pines will drop all of their foliage in one fantastic display that we like to call the needle toss?
I didn't know that. When does this happen?
Well, it's, you know, it tends to be every winter. What happens is the, you know, the Julius formulas that are seeping through all of the grounds, they tend to sometimes have a bit of a flash freeze, and that kind of shocks all the trees in the park to suddenly go into what we like to call spontaneous hibernation. I apologize, the scientific term is spontaneous involuntary hibernation. And the trees in that shocked moment will sort of expel the needles at high velocities in whatever direction they happen to be sagging at that time. And so, you know, around, you know, mid-February, we ask that our park goers grab a riot shield from the visitor center before entering the park, because there is a very good chance that they will just, you know, get just a face full of needles.
Well, and at high velocity, these things have been known to pop car tires, shatter windshields, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've had, you know, between the tumbleweed and the needle toss, I mean, the amount of body damage we've done to our visitors' vehicles is just astronomical.
Well, what a fascinating piece of Mauve Stone trivia. I didn't know that.
And I didn't know that either. But guys, did you know Mauve Stone has no shortage of visitor information?
It stands to reason, Elliot, but explain.
One of the defining features of any national park is its information stand and information placards around the park, so you can learn a thing or two while you're there. What Mauve Stone has done is put so many placards that they have become a feature in and of themselves. A lot of trees are cut down just to make these information placards that really don't say that much. Mostly just next placard this way. Rod, what was the thinking behind this?
You know, we had an issue where a lot of our park goers were just sort of wandering aimlessly through the wastes. You know, and that just, as you can imagine, could cause some serious problems in the long run. So it was decided that we would make the placard sort of a feature of the park in the hopes that they would sort of be sort of indirectly led through safer routes through the park. You know, we've got, you know, we have what we call a placard way, which is a marked path, a marked walking path, about a half a mile to a mile, I believe, depending on the time of year, because part of the path is on what turns out to be actually a buried landfill, so the ground shifts very significantly depending on rainfall and ground temperature.
I've also noticed that instead of an overarching map with a small "you are here" dot, you have "you are here" placards almost every 10 feet in lieu of a giant map.
Yes, that's correct. Park goers, you know, if they pick up the decoder manual at the visitor center when they come in, they'll notice that each placard has a small symbol etched into the lower right corner. And so if they use that symbol and then go into the decoder manual, and then that will find the serial number for that placard.
That's in a different manual, right?
Yes, then you need to grab, that's right, you need to grab the serial number manual. And then if you then check that serial number against your GPS location. Oh, you should also grab a GPS locator from the visitor center as well. I cannot stress that enough.
Didn't you say cellular service wasn't that great in the park?
It is not great. We try to we also have placards leading the park goers to our Wi-Fi hotspot, which of which we have one. And it's recommended that they check their GPS there and then perhaps commit what they can see to memory before continuing on through the park.
So the process will be go to one of these placards, consult the symbol in the manual, cross-reference the serial number in your other manual, and then go to the GPS hotspot, and so you can quickly reference where you were that you thought you are.
That's correct.
Okay.
I think that's clear as day. What a novel and easy to use and, dare I say, intuitive means of navigating an otherwise labyrinthal park. I didn't know that, guys, but did you guys know that Milestone had battled a rash of forest fires in the 80s?
Wow, I didn't know that, Vince. So what happened?
Well, in an effort to curb camper-related fires, they lent themselves to a bit of a mascot and an advertising campaign, spearheaded by Ashy the Porcupine. His slogan was, "Only you can't not do any more fires."
So was this a successful campaign?
Almost historically not. It confused listeners and readers, and children started enthusiastically starting more forest fires in and around Milestone National Park. Were you around for those days?
I was around for the tail end of that, yes. My first day in the park, in fact, they asked me... to just go around the park and look for any signs. What happened is a lot of enthusiasts, they had made a bunch of little comic books about the porcupine. And the kids would tend to mark their way with the porcupine as sort of a monument to the porcupine itself. It sort of turned into what some have called a cult. Where the kids sort of developed a almost religious fervor for the porcupine and their interpretation of the porcupine's love of the flame. So I would just sort of be looking for these little, the pictures of the cute little porcupine, and that would generally lead me to yet another site where some children were trying to burn down a sagging pine or... a pile of bipolar finches that were in one of their more depressive phases.
So these were kids around in the 80s. Some say that these cults are still somewhere in the park.
Yes, that is correct. We have, we occasionally have sightings of, some very, very dirty-looking human people who apparently fashioned branches to the backs of their clothes, I guess a way of sort of resembling the porcupine. And occasionally, I'll see a column of smoke coming from across the park. But usually by the time I get there, it's just sort of a crater of ash, I guess I would call it.
Some people speculated that they subsist solely on a deposit of Auntie Annie's cookies that they found in the park.
I can't confirm or deny that. I've certainly seen many pieces of what appear to be baked good wrappers. They're generally burned nearly beyond recognition, of course. I imagine if this is the case, they tend to use the wrappers as one of their primary fuel sources.
Well, this has been, I hesitate to say illuminating, given the context of the conversation, but certainly educating and undeniably interesting. Thank you, Rod Jodd, park ranger here at Milestone National Park, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to give us what has been a splendid day at Milestone.
Of course, it was a real hoot to, talk to some people that weren't, either rolling their eyes in apparent boredom or disgust, or some kind of delusional arson cult member. So it's been a real treat.
Well, the pleasure was all ours.
Absolutely.
I hope you'll join us, and listeners, we hope you'll join us on our final segment. Wish you were here.
So listeners, We know that you can't come with us, even though we'd love you to each and every week. So the next best thing is an audio postcard from us to you from the town that we're staying in. It goes a little something like this. Dear listener, wish you were here in Mauvstone, Wyoming.
One of the most impressive towns we've been to with the least impressive geological features.
Home to such natural beauties as Old Philanderer, the Bland Canyon, and the ever-escaping Tumbleweed.
And home, purposefully or not, to Ranger Rod Jodd.
A man on a mission to discover the secrets of Big Hands, Orange Julius chemical warfare, and the ever-burning cult of Ashy the Porcupine.
So listeners, we hope you'll make the trek to Mauvstone now or in the near future. Fingers crossed.
Farewell from these parts to yours.
Hey listeners, thanks again for joining us for another episode of These Parts. Hope you enjoyed our time in Mauvstone, Wyoming. And I hope that you come with us next week when we're going to be in Shemp, Idaho.
Shemp, Idaho is a living shrine to the underappreciated First Third Stooge. Slapstick, it pretty much overwhelms day-to-day activities, and we're excited to go. Hopefully you join us next week.